Mm-hmm. In terms of spending a lot of time at it, we're fortunate we have an annotated book of our papers, which our local historian Bruce Wilson, or Bruce Mitchell, has kept up for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we usually can find the important things that have happened over the last 75 years.
Yeah. And the Wenatchee World, your father's involvement in it, I think, was about 1905, is that right?
Well, he came into Wenatchee in 1904,
mm-hmm.
Worked for a couple of weeklies. The paper was started in 1905 by a couple of fellows that came in from the coast. Dad bought the paper in 1907 and stayed with it then until 1950 when he passed away.
How about some of the earlier papers there? I know there were some in the 90s. Is there any record left of them?
The first newspaper in Wenatchee was the Advance, and we have a number of copies of the old Advance printed back in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
by a lawyer by the name of Reeves. There isn't a complete file of the early papers here.
What kind of things were you likely to find in the old Wenatchee Advances if you were to browse through them?
Well, of course, you got to remember that back in the 90s, the railroad came through here, but the only transportation up north, of course, was by steamboat.
Mm-hmm.
From the time that the railroad came until 1914, when the Great Northern built its spur line to Oroville. So there was a lot of comings and goings through Wenatchee, and it was always difficult because those steamboat rides took a lot of time.
Yeah, yeah. In your perusals of the Advance, here in the Lakeshoreland Valley, the local paper was, while it professed not to be a boom sheet for a town site, it certainly was. Was the Advance that way, saying this is going to be a major city someday?
Oh my! It was full. It was full of stories of development, stories of the mining that was going on at that time. Everybody was looking for gold, and there were lots of wild-eyed schemes, you know, being proposed in those days.
Yeah.
and the papers were full of it at that time.
Well, Lisa, maybe we should talk a little bit about your father, and we know that he showed up in Wenatchee in 1904, but who was he, and where did he come from?
Well, he was a lawyer by training. He and his twin brother, identical twin brother Ralph, were graduates of the University of Nebraska Law School, who had spent summers going to the Yukon to work on a riverboat during the gold rush. My father's brother, Ralph, settled in Tacoma, and he became a lawyer and stayed with it. Dad tried lawyering, but he didn't like it, so he came over here and decided to go into the newspaper business.
Now, was he a married man when he arrived in the Wenatchee area?
No, he was courting my mother, who came from the same little town in Nebraska, but... they weren't married until 1909. She came out and married him 5 years after he settled here.
Kind of a long-distance courtship.
Yes, in those days, things took a little longer.
Yeah. Now, when your father took over, bought out the Wenatchee World, how did he come to do that?
The paper was in real difficulties financially. It had about 400 subscribers daily. The town... I would guess was about 4,000 population. It was in a real big growth period because the High Line Ditch was under construction at that time. The old bridge across the Columbia was under construction too, and they had great prospects for prosperity, He said at the time that he came here, Wenatchee was perhaps the most dismal-looking place on the whole of the Great Northern Line from St. Paul to Seattle, but he liked the prospects.
Okay, so what kind of changes did he make in the paper to get it on its feet?
Well, Dad was a promoter. He was a he liked to go out and get things done. He ran into a local opposition when a group of local business people, however, started a rival daily in 1908 called the Republic, a very fine daily newspaper put out in the afternoon just like the World. And it forced my father to go outside for business. And so he started to travel Okanagan County and Grant County, and Perry County, looking for business outside of Wenatchee. And he knew all of the old-timers in the whole of this five-county area, knew them because he had written their names as subscribers down or had signed them up for advertising or had sold them job work. At that time, he had a job shop. And that's the only way he survived, was to go outside of the immediate city limits for business. The other paper folded finally in 1914, and then he was alone.
Well, the other paper gave a pretty good run then, didn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. It was a real hard battle. And the terminology of those days was slanderous, to say the least, when one paper attacked another. I always remember an attack that the Republic carried on against the World, and they described the World in a headline on the front page. In these terms, the headline said, "The Sordid Motives of Our Strumpet Contemporary." And in those days, libel wasn't very much of a problem.
Yeah, apparently not. There was a battle going between two weeklies up here that had the same kind of tones to it at times.
Yeah, it's very amusing to read some of those old newspapers.
Have you had an interest personally in history, Wilfred, or do you have a favorite topic or favorite area of history of the Wenatchee area that you like to delve into?
Well, I don't think that there's a favorite kind of history, but I'm intrigued with some of the old explorations. I've just been reading the trip through central Washington of the Wilkes Expedition, which was an army expedition that came through here in the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
I just got a copy of that, and it told about how they came from the Yakima over the Clallam and how desolate this country was. And they told of meeting the Indian tribes as they came through here. They went up the river. They had to cross over the river at Antioch, just above Antioch, because of the earthquake point there. They couldn't get through there. Of course, this was before the earthquake shook down Ribbon Cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Went up the other side and then over the plateau into the Mansfield country and out at Bridgeport. And Okanagan, Fort Okanagan at that time was in operation. The old history of this part of the world isn't very old, you know, in terms of the history of the United States, but it intrigues me how recent the pioneering era was in this part of the world.
I think that's the thing that makes it a joy for those of us who look into history, because you don't have very far to look out here.
No, that's right.
Keith, did your father have any contact with some of the old Indian leaders?
Oh, yes, indeed. He certainly did. As a matter of fact, he was good friends of many of the Nez Perce leaders in the Colville. I can remember groups of Indian chiefs coming down to visit, and I remember one day he brought them all home, and very unexpectedly, my mother put up with a lot of very unexpected things, because he didn't warn her, and he just marched this group into the kitchen, and I think he fed them breakfast himself. They couldn't speak English, and I was quite young at the time, but I remember vividly how much mutual respect they had for each other.
Well, for one thing that has intrigued me in the 4 or 5 years that we've done history research here is how young the Wild West is too. You know, we tend to think of the old days of Gunsmoke as taking place maybe primarily in Hollywood and never being real, but they were in a sense. You had the Harry Tracy case.
That's right.
What was it, 1908 or so, I think that was.
Yeah.
Do you remember, or did your father talk much to you at all about some of those wilder times? Was Wenatchee a western town?
Well, I don't recall specifically hearing about any really wild things that happened here. Of course, the Tracy affair, when the outlaw came across the Clackamas and then went out into the wheat country where he was finally surrounded and shot to death, didn't touch very many people here. But there was always violence, you know, in this part of the world. I don't believe that I was aware of very much that went on here, specifically in Wenatchee. Some of the early mining towns, of course, had a lot more of that kind of thing. Up in the Okanagan, and Old Ruby, and I think they had lots of shootings and things of that nature in some of those. But this was, you know, primarily agricultural and a business center. And as I recall, we didn't have much of that kind of thing going on here.
Yeah. I think probably the single project that people who are around today remember your father for being involved in was the Grand Coulee Dam, and being one of the major promoters of it. But there were a lot of other things that he was pushing for a lot earlier than that, weren't there?
Oh, yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, he was involved in trying to irrigate the Quincy area with a project back in 1912. There was a state bond issue proposed, turned down by the voters, which would have built a line from Lake Wenatchee under the Columbia River, or over it, by pipeline to Quincy. That was kind of a predecessor, but there were a lot of schemes that he was interested in. He was interested in seeing the country develop. And in those days, there wasn't very much here, and it was hard pulling to get anything done.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, the Columbia Basin Project was his primary interest, and he wrote the first article proposing it back on a July day in 1918. He picked that idea up from Billy Clapp of Ephrata one day on a trip down to that town. The idea of a dam didn't originate at that time. It had been proposed perhaps years before from time to time. But I think the significance of that story was that it came at a time that sparked interest to form an organization to see if they couldn't do something about it. And a group met after that time and organized to promote this kind of a plan. It was really the initial spark of local interest in getting that big project started.
Who was Billy Clapp?
Well, Billy Clapp was a businessman in Ephrata, and Billy lived on until recent years. He was had been there for a long time. I don't recall what year he came to Ephrata, but he was the source of that particular story.
So it would have been a topic that came up in conversation between he and your father sort of took off with it then.
That's correct.
Do you remember that story as he wrote it? Did it propose a location? Did it?
Oh, yes, indeed. I have copies of it. We reprinted the thing. If you'd like, in just a moment, I'll read you the headline that he wrote on that thing. Hang on just a minute, and
okay.
I'll get that for you.
We'll take a commercial break and come back and hear it then.
Okay.
Okay. It's 13 minutes now before 10 o'clock, and we're on the phone this morning talking in our month of heritage with Wilfred Woods. Wilfred, you were going to be looking for the the headline on your father's story proposing that a great dam be built. What have you found there?
Yes, I have a copy of it in front of me. It was dated 18th of July, 1918. And the headline says, "Formulate brand new idea for irrigation, Grant, Adams, Franklin counties, covering million acres or more." And then the story says, "The last, the newest, the most ambitious idea in the way of reclamation and the development of water power ever formulated is now in the process of development. The idea contemplates turning the Columbia River back into its old bed in Grand Coulee by the construction of a giant dam. The reclamation of between 1 and 2 million acres of land in Grant, Adams, and Franklin counties, and the development of a water power approximating Niagara Falls. It was first conceived by William Clapp of Ephrata, who kept it under his hat for several months, owing to the fact that it appeared to be at first as an evanescent dream. But as the idea began to develop, he talked it over with some of his friends. It so appealed to the Grant County commissioners that they have sent the county engineer to look the matter up from an engineer's standpoint." And then it goes on to talk about some of the details of it.
What was the reaction to that story? I still have people that when I look at the Grand Coulee Dam, I don't think they could have built it sometimes. You know what I mean?
It was a long fight. First of all, a big dam at Grand Coulee interfered with a dam site on the upper Columbia above that in the reservoir area with a power company from Spokane. And so the power company in Spokane fought tooth and toenail, as did every other of the private companies, against a public development of that kind. There was a 25-year battle, as a matter of fact, for it.
Mm-hmm.
The breakthrough to prove the feasibility of this project came when the Corps of Engineers was authorized to make its original study of the Columbia River, called the original 308 report.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, the Hoover administration went ahead and engineered it. They put a feasibility study of the Grand Coulee Project, the Columbia Basin Project, and Coulee Dam together. But they couldn't contemplate appropriating that kind of money. It just looked like too much.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, Franklin Roosevelt came along. The dam had been engineered, and he started the construction of Grand Coulee Dam as a public works project to make work. Without congressional authorization, it was not authorized as a reclamation project. And the need to put people to work really resulted in the starting of that whole project.
You know, I have often wondered what would have happened to the concept without the Depression, without that need to put the people to work.
Oh, I don't think it would have been started. The cost looked really tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big objection to building power facilities for what they regarded as the jackrabbits. They said that there wasn't any need for these large amounts of power. And, of course, as it turned out, the power came online just at the time that the country was going to war, The first power came out of Grand Coulee just exactly 40 years ago this month.
Mm-hmm.
And that resulted in the aluminum industry being settled in the Northwest to make aluminum for airplanes. It also enabled the Hanford Works to be started as a nuclear weapons factory because they had power to help make the plutonium.
Yeah.
So a lot of things happened as a result of that accidental start of construction on a dam.
Well, let me backtrack a little bit here.
Sure.
And talk to you about, I think most of us who are familiar with the paper are familiar with your father's reputation as a professional man. I'd like to talk a little bit about the way you would have known him as a boy. What kind of a man was he?
Well, he was, first of all, he was a great traveler. He made national news by picking up with nothing but a briefcase and going to Russia in 1931. And he'd pick up and travel around the world at the drop of a hat. He loved to go, and so he took us traveling east as children, my two sisters and me, many times when we were growing up to visit the family back in Nebraska, and so we had a lot of fun traveling with him. He never did take us overseas, but.
What were your topics of conversation around the house? Did he come home and talk about this great big dam that he wanted to see built, or did he leave work at the office?
No, he did a lot of his writing at home,
mm-hmm.
and he liked to bring company home. He liked to talk about issues. He was a great one to invite people into town to ask them about their own backgrounds and interests, and he put together a daily column that was really a very far-ranging interest to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a little difficult to recapture conversations, but
sure.
He was always interested in issues, and certainly he was interested in public issues of what was happening. He was a Republican, but he supported development, which put him in opposition to many Republicans who didn't want to see any public enterprise in the power business, such as this Columbia Basin project.
Yeah.
He was kind of a maverick Republican, incidentally.
Mm-hmm.
He had supported Theodore Roosevelt and the progressives back in the early days, which put him at odds with the traditional Republican Party at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a delegate to the Republican Convention of 1924, the national convention that at which Harding was nominated. And he was intensely interested in foreign affairs, and that's one of the reasons that he traveled widely. I've got a tremendous library that he picked up. He was a great reader. He did a lot of reading of the Bible in addition to historical things. And so we've got a lot of fine historical books that he left for us here at the office.
Was he a man who enjoyed sitting down and having serious conversations with his children?
Yes, although, you know, kids don't look on their parents usually very much as being objects of serious consideration for conversation.
Well, point there. Wilford, how is it that you came to be involved with the newspaper? Did your father encourage that, or did...
I used to work in the back shop, and I worked in the press, and I worked in the composing room, and he put me in different departments when I was during my school years and my college years, and so when he passed away, I just moved into the head shop, and I've been running it ever since.
Yeah. When did you first get involved with the paper yourself?
Well, I the year after high school, I stayed and became a printer for a year,
mm-hmm.
That was back in 1938, so I've been here quite a while.
Do you remember the first story that you were sent out to report on or anything like that?
Well, I did spend some time in, as a result of a hand infection I got as a printer, I moved to, in the springtime with my Aunt Eva Anderson, whose husband had the Chevrolet garage, the Mack Chevrolet in Chelan, and I spent some time that spring interviewing some of the Indians of that area, Peter Wapato in particular, and went up to the St. Mary's Mission at Omak to do some writing about some of the Indian work that was going on up there. I remember particularly Peter Wapato telling about his younger days, and of course he lived down near Earthquake Point where the big earthquake shook off the cliff, and talked about his training as a boy and how he would go out into the hills alone. I was always intrigued with the Wapato family, and certainly I'm glad to see fine development out at Wapato Point finally taking place.
When you talked with Peter, was he an easy man to talk to?
Yes, he was well along in years at that time, but he was very friendly, and Mrs. Anderson, my aunt, went along at the same time, and we had a good conversation. You may remember there was an Indian church on Indian land just east of Wapato Point, near the pumping plant there now for the Manson Project, and we went out and I took his picture out there at Wapato, at the Indian church. Of course, it's since burned down and is no longer there, but I remember that very well.
Did you have to have an interpreter to talk with Peter?
No, he spoke English.
How did he feel about the white man, the development that had occurred here?
Well, Wapato was a man that liked things that went on there. They held horse races out on the point, and there used to be quite a lot of activity at the point. I don't think I ever attended one of those races, but in those early years, there apparently was quite a lot of activity that they carried on.
Yeah, we just did a feature story this morning on the Wapato family and their horse races. They started they started before the white man came, of course, but one of the more interesting things that I found was a statement from John Wapato that was made in an interview with a local paper in 1939, that when the white man's fort was here in 1880,
yes,
they got together and raced a lot and had a pretty good time with each other, apparently. At any rate, it's 10 o'clock, by the way, at KOZI Chelan. We're talking this morning with Wilfred Woods about the Wenatchee World and other adventures. Wilfred, were you working with the paper during World War II?
No, I was in the Army Air Force. I spent 4 years in the Air Force at that time.
What did you do in the war?
Well, I was in the Army's 1st Jet Squadron. The fighter jet group. It never did leave California because about the time the group got its fighter planes, the European war ended, and all they needed was bombers for the Japanese theater. So I spent most of the war in California. That was tough duty.
Yeah. were you a pilot or?
No. I was enlisted man in the administrative part.
There must have been some secrecy involved in that particular unit, if you were.
Yes, we were out in the desert. Outside of Palmdale, and they wouldn't let people in and out. It was quite a new thing at that time, very intriguing.
Did they let you in and out?
Sure. I went to Los Angeles every weekend. It wasn't that secret. Then the Lockheed was building the planes down in Los Angeles, and people down there knew all about it.
Yeah. One thing that we've done with each of the people that we've talked with who are old enough to remember the era is asked what you were doing on the 7th of December in 41.
Oh, I remember that very well. I was in college in Tacoma, and I was driving to Seattle. I don't know the reason. I think I was going up for a luncheon when we heard the news on the radio. And I stayed in college then until the summer of 1942 when I went into the Army.
What kind of reaction did you have when you heard about it on the radio? Did it surprise you?
Oh, yes, very much so. I wasn't prepared for it, and like most college students, I was deeply involved in college, what was happening there, and I really wasn't very much aware of what the international implications, what was going on. Of course, the war was on in Europe, and we knew that, but certainly didn't expect to see a sudden bombing for Pearl Harbor.
Where were you going to college again, though?
It was the College of Puget Sound, and now the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma.
Now, I know that there was an enemy submarine into the mouth of the Columbia River. Some fears of there were balloon bombs that were dropped, incendiary devices that fortunately didn't work very well. Spending your time on that side of the state, was there fear of a Japanese invasion?
Well, the thing that I remember most was that a number of my classmates who were Nisei had to pack up and leave and go to one of these relocation camps. And I felt very sorry for some good friends of mine, and I think it really has turned out to be one of the aspects of that war that we can't feel very good about, because there was really no evidence of any problems with the Nisei and in the West Coast. But there were terrible rumors at that time, and it was a very sudden decision by the Army to pack these folks off.
Yeah. We're talking this morning with Wilford Woods. We're going to take another commercial break, and we'll come back in just a moment. I'm enjoying this. Are you Q-World, of course? Wilford, a story that I ran across in the local paper recently talked about some labor unrest up here in the Lake Chelan Valley in 1939. It made quite a splash, and that was a strike at Holden Mine. Do you remember, of course, I suppose you would have been in high school then, but do you remember much of the events of how people in the outside the immediate Chelan area were reacting to the mining at Holden?
Well, of course, Holden started work in 1937 there, and it was quite an event. But I was just getting out of high school and going into college. Mm-hmm. We have been running in our Sunday paper for the last 2 months a series of historical articles written by Nigel Adams, a historian at Green River College, on the background of the Holden Mine before 1937.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to put it into booklet form sometime before the end of the year, as soon as we can put it together.
Yeah.
And Nigel grew up in Holden, became a historian, certainly knows the background of the Holden Mine. It was a very intriguing story. This was his doctoral dissertation for his PhD that he used.
Mm-hmm.
It was rewritten, and we hope to get it out to the public one of these days.
I followed most of the articles, and they're fascinating.
The story, of course, of production from 37 on to 57, when it closed, have not been told. I would hope that somebody would follow through and do the rest of the story, because Holden was a most unusual kind of a development way back there, and so far back, with transportation problems and with its own little self-contained community. My wife grew up in Chelan and used to visit friends in Holden when they were operating, and tell some wonderful stories of the big snowfalls that they used to get in that area.
When When you think of, there must be times when you sit there in your office and wax philosophical, I guess, perhaps, you know, your family's involvement with the newspapering, with the Central Washington area has been quite a long one. Are there things that, as you look back in some of your old papers or think about the old papers, say, gee, I wish those papers could tell me more about this or that?
Well, you know, I think that we need to remember how difficult it was to get anything done in the old days, mm-hmm. because somehow it seems today that the only thing we're concerned about is, or many people are concerned about, is the stopping things from happening rather than trying to see things get done. And I know that we all have concerns about our environmental problems and what we're going to do, but I hate to see a philosophy of negativism against anything that's new or that means a change, because, you know, we really can't stop change. We're going to change regardless. I don't believe we want to mess up our country, but, you know, I don't think that this country was built on people who stood back and said, we don't want anything any different than the way it is now.
Yeah. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you is, you mentioned you got started working in almost all the different departments in the paper, or all of them. What are the differences between the way mechanically your paper is put out now and the way it was when you first started working in it?
Oh, my goodness. We had a large staff of printers. We had to go through the old process of setting everything in hot type and then going to a stereotype plate, then taking that heavy 50-pound plate and putting it on a letter press. And one of the changes that I've noticed, of course, is that the cold type and the computerized production today is so different from what it was then. A linotype would produce 7 or 8 lines of type per minute, or in the later production models, more than 10, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
We have phototype setters today that are producing 150 lines a minute. We have 3 of them. We're now probably looking at another generation of typesetters in the next couple of years. It'll produce from 600 to 1,000 lines of type a minute, and do it very easily and without any strain. I think that's one of the things that's changed things. We still have to have trained printers, but there aren't as many of them as there used to be. Our news production, of course, is by typing a story electronically on a tube, on a terminal. They call it a VDT, video display terminal, but it's just a television tube.
Mm-hmm.
And then instead of sending it down to have a printer reproduce it, it is electronically sent to our computer. The computer sends it on signal to direct to the typesetters, and it comes out just as the reporter or the advertising salesman puts it in. And if he puts it in wrong, it comes out wrong.
I was going to say, what happened to the editing process? If a guy can't spell, does it...
the computer can't spell any more than the linotype machine could spell. It's all up to the man that originates or a woman that originates it.
So you better have a dictionary handy.
Yeah, we give spelling tests to everybody that comes in here, and we're very much concerned about the problem of grammatical and misspellings, grammatical consistency.
Well, you know,
it's really a bugbear for us.
The difference between a broadcast journalist and a newspaper journalist is who did well in spelling in school, you see.
Yes, the only thing we notice from you fellas is if you can't pronounce Puyallup or Nespelum or something.
Right, but we don't have to spell it.
No, you don't have to spell it.
In terms of the time it takes to put a fast-breaking story on your front page, I imagine you can do it much faster now than you would have been able to do it in the 30s or 40s. Huh?
Yes, we can put a story into film. It's not type any longer. It's a photographic film for what we call a paste-up. For our one of our pages, it is almost as fast as the typesetter works, just a few minutes. So our deadlines really haven't changed that much, but we produce later news more easily than we could before.
In your time in the paper, there have been some very, very big stories there. What story disrupted or your operation the most or caused it the most exciting thing that's happened around your office since you've been there, I guess?
Well, I think of big national events like the assassination of President Kennedy that just turned all of us into turmoil. Any of these large events of this nature were really traumatic for a news operation that has a fixed deadline and is trying to fit news into it. Another one that I remember very vividly is the big explosion that took place down at Apple Yard when that tank car exploded, and we were forced to change our whole news format virtually instantaneously.
That came out at a bad time of day for you folks, too, didn't it?
It sure did.
12:30 in the afternoon or something.
That's right. That's right. We put everybody to work and we came out late as a result, of course. But we did get the story in that day's paper.
Yeah. Let's take as an example of, well, you mentioned it, when President Kennedy was assassinated. Probably for each individual American at the time, whether they approved his presidency or not, that was a terribly traumatic thing. And yet, in your profession, you were required to work through that trauma, where most of the rest of us in the country could let it floor us. We could sit down. Is that a hard type thing to do?
Well, you're so busy trying to take care of the mechanical things that you're terribly busy, and the whole plant is to try to get these things in as quickly as possible. And this is true at every major news breaking story of national import. Time to us is really important, because we don't want to be a day late if we can help it on an important news story.
Yeah,
we aren't as let me say that we're not as as hyper about it perhaps as we once were, because I think newspapers recognize that electronic media, radio and television, both have advantages in the timing problem. So we have tended to go to more kinds of news that are more explanatory, and to use our facilities for things that are better suited for our particular medium, and that is full explanations, pictorial things, pictures, maps, commentary on various events and things of that nature. And I think that we have seen rather a substantial change in how daily newspapers, at least, approach the problems of this kind.
Do you sometimes, when I watch television or movies or whatever, it seems as though any program that deals with a social issue talks about boy, when those guys in the press get a hold of this, it's going to be terrible. And you know, there's a very negative thing put out about people who are in the press. Do your newspaper reporters walk around and puff cigars and buttonhole people all the time? Or, you know, how do you feel about those kinds of images that you see?
Well, the press is, in a sense, the natural enemy, almost, of those who don't want a full story told many times. I think we regard ourselves many times as natural antagonists to some degree with many kinds of government that don't particularly want to tell everything that goes on. And I think there are problems of balance in the news media. And I think it's very obvious that there are some very bad things that happen as a result of some newspapers or other kinds of media magazines. I think the case of the National Enquirer is a pretty good case in point that I wouldn't try to defend. But I think we want to remember that there isn't any safeguard in a democracy that matches the safeguard of free speech and free inquiry. And the First Amendment is still our best bulwark, all of our bulwark, for the kind of a society that we have. And I'm sure that we all have disagreed with the policies of many media in the way they've done things, and I'm sure I have sometimes too. But I think sometimes we forget that a principle of free speech means for everybody, and it isn't just for the press, it's for the public as well. And if we ever have a situation where the government does not allow us to report what's going on and comment on what's going on, even though they don't agree with it, and even though the press may be wrong, mm-hmm. we're in trouble.
I've always kind of likened it to a situation, if you're watching a sporting event, you don't always know what the umpire says in a ball game is his opinion.
And yeah.
As a journalist, I sort of feel like, you know, you're supposed to write it the facts as you know them. I don't think most of us would say that we are able to determine before any given story is written all of the truth and tell the whole thing. We do the best we can with it. And a reader or a listener should keep that in mind, I would think.
Well, I think that sometimes that when we get a member of the media that abuses his privilege, and some of them do,
mm-hmm.
We tend to forget that an essential ingredient in a kind of a system that we have is important. If we pinch down on the ability to know what's going on in government, we're in trouble indeed.
Wilford, I know I've taken a lot of your time already this morning, but there is one topic that I did want to mention. Much of our Month of Heritage this year is centered around water. For us, the Chelan River, Lake Chelan, and the Columbia River. And probably one of the bigger stories with the Columbia River in your tenure with the Wenatchee World was in 1948 with the flood there. Do you remember that?
Oh, I certainly do. I was covering the flood as a photographer for the paper at that time.
How did you have to wear boots, or what did you do?
Well, I remember flying into Twist when there wasn't any way to get there except to get a plane to fly from the airport across the river. I flew the Okanagan County and shot aerial pictures of that. I remember the terrible mess on Lake Chelan with all the debris that plugged up so that it was virtually impossible to have normal boat traffic. You never saw so much debris in all your life on Lake Chelan in 1948. It was absolutely incredible. And of course, it wrecked Prince Creek and it tore up the Stehekin. That was a year that was, and I don't think anybody that was here then will forget it.
What was the impact in Wenatchee? How much did the river encroach on the city?
Well, it flooded the pumping plant, so for a period of time our pumping plant was not able to deliver water to Combs.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, really, the flooding in this area didn't amount to that much. The road system of the Mattow Valley was ruined. There was a lot of flooding in the Okanagan, and of course downriver Vanport, a city of 18,000, was wiped out of existence by the dike that gave way and flooded that whole city out. It was a miracle nobody was killed in that or drowned.
Did the flooding affect the operation of the paper? I mean, without roads into the net, how'd the paper get up there, or did it?
Well, we made every effort to get to some of these places. There were some points for a few days that we just couldn't get papers to because the main highway was flooded. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't remember exactly what we did at that time, but we had a large number of readers up in the Okanagan, and we had a terrible time getting into the Met Hall. I think we flew our papers into the Met Hall for a while because there weren't any roads open at that time. And it took quite a while for normal transportation to be rebuilt into there.
That must have been an exciting time for you to be able to be out and watching all that happen on the plane and such.
Well, it was a busy time, and of course you didn't have time to think about it. You just went and did it.
Are there times when you're in your position now, as the boss, when you think you'd rather be a reporter?
Well, I'm pretty comfortable. I've got people that are really more competent than I was at the reporting business, so I'm quite content to stay with my own role, and I like it very much.
Okay. Wilfred, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us this morning. We've really enjoyed it a great deal.
Well, I've enjoyed it, too. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Talking this morning with the